top stories, Iran's judiciary chief says the U.S. assassination of anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani will fail to undermine the resistance front. Iran warns the U.N. Security Council about the U.S., quote, warmongering tendencies and provocative moves in the Persian Gulf region. Also in headlines, Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon says Scotland would be back in the European Union soon as the UK finally leaves the bloc after a 48-year partnership. Our top story, Iran has held a ceremony to mark the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Senior Iranian officials and military commanders attended the ceremony in the capital, Tehran. Iran's judiciary chief, Ebrahim Raisi, said the assassination of anti-terror commander Soleimani will fail to undermine the resistance front. Raisi warned enemies that they should await Iran's harsh revenge for the killing. He said the U.S. president or anyone else as a murderer will not be immune. The head of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps also addressed the gathering. Brigadier General Ismail Qa'ani said Soleimani was the hero of defeating arrogance. Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone attack in Iraq on January 3, 2020. Foreign guests were also in attendance at the ceremony to mark the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani. A senior official of Lebanon's Hezbollah said the resistance movement will continue the path of Soleimani. Hashem Safieddine also said Soleimani and assassinated Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis protected the world against the Daesh terror group. The head of Iraq's popular mobilization units addressed the ceremony in Tehran as well. Faleh Fayyad also said the assassinated Iranian general sacrificed his life for protecting Iraq against its enemies. He also said Soleimani and Mohandas raised public awareness about regional developments. To Iranians, General Soleimani was an anti-terror icon who played a key role in maintaining security in their country. But his popularity among Iranians goes beyond a charismatic commander who defeated the Daesh terror group. Soleimani is also highly appreciated for his selflessness and modesty. That explains why people refer to him as the Commander of Hearts.
Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, visiting a group of children in the northern province of Mazandaran months before his assassination. These children were amongst many more who had lost their fathers in Iran's anti-terror operations. The top general had a message for the children, that he is always there despite being busy as a military commander. And he did whatever he could to fill the void those children had, being so kind that the kids expressed their feelings whenever they wished, even if it was in the middle of praying. But now, all those moments are over. They came to an end after Soleimani lost his life in a U.S. drone attack near Iraq's capital, Baghdad. The bad news came to the Iranians in the early hours of January 3, 2020. Many demanded revenge for the killing of a person they called the Commander of Hearts. They all remembered that Soleimani was a man of the people, a man who considered it an honor to serve those in need. That was quite clear in the spring of 2019 when many Iranian provinces were hit by devastating floods. General Soleimani and a number of friends went to the southern province of Khuzestan, one of the hardest hit areas by the unprecedented deluge. There, he joined others delivering relief and aid to flood-hit people. He extended his support to anyone needed within his reach. A humble person that behaved his countrymen with respect, regardless of his position as the head of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, a key force responsible for Iran's anti-terror operations overseas. Millions turned out for Soleimani's funeral processions held in several Iranian cities, including his hometown, Kerman. The ceremonies were the last chance for people to pay respect to a person they were always proud of, not only for his brave actions on the front line, but more for his humane behavior.
Let's look at some other world stories for you now. Iran has issued a stern warning to the United Nations Security Council about the U.S.'s recent provocative moves in the Persian Gulf. In a letter to the Council, Iran's permanent mission to the U.N. said the U.S. has ramped up its military presence and activities in the region in recent weeks. Iran raised the alarm over what it called U.S. warmongering tendencies, adding that Washington must bear the full responsibility of the consequences. The letter also echoed Iran Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif's remarks, who said Iran does not seek war but will openly and directly defend its people, security, and vital interests. Tensions in the region escalated after U.S. President Donald Trump accused Iran of playing a role in the attacks on the U.S. embassy in Iraq late last month, threatening retaliation. The U.S. says it is bringing back the only Navy aircraft carrier operating in the Middle East. The Pentagon says the aircraft carrier will transit directly home to complete a nearly 10-month development, or I should say deployment. The carrier had been in the region to provide air cover during troop drawdowns in Afghanistan and Somalia. The decision to bring it back comes a day after the U.S. flew two bombers over the Persian Gulf. That was the second time in December the Pentagon flew the bombers there. The move comes as tensions run high between the U.S. and Iran. Those tensions escalated, as I said, after U.S. assassinated top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani last year. The U.S. has rejected the U.N.'s 2021 program budget, citing what it called anti-Semitism and failure to pressure Iran. Washington found no international support at the world body. Only Israel voted with the U.S. against the U.N. budget. The U.S. said the budget would fund the 20th anniversary of the U.N. conference critical of Israeli policies. American ambassador to the U.N., Kelly Craft, said the April event is poisoned with what she called anti-Semitism and anti-Israel bias. Craft also said the U.S. received no support at the U.N. in September when it pushed for a return of international sanctions on Iran. The U.N. also rejected a U.S. bid to extend an anti-Iran arms embargo that ended in October. Washington was isolated in November as well, when no one backed its amendments to a resolution on health issues. The UK has officially left the European Union after a long battle with the bloc to secure a trade deal. Britain cut all ties with the EU from 2300 hours GMT on Thursday when it left Europe's single market and customs union. London managed to forge a trade agreement with Brussels last week to avoid a no-deal exit. Prime Minister Boris Johnson described the departure as a new beginning for the UK while keeping the EU as the country's biggest ally. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, however, told Europe to, quote, keep the light on because Scotland would be back soon. Brexit has dominated British politics since the country's close vote to leave the bloc in June of 2016. Political commentator Mr. Jonathan Fryer says the UK's official exit from the EU is a big loss for Britain, and the situation is far from settled.
Yes, that's correct. The situation is still far from settled. Of course, a lot of people in Britain are relieved that the Brexit debate is over. It's taken us over 4 years to get to this stage, and now we have formally left the European Union, the single market, etc. But it's going to take years to work out details of various trade negotiations, because although we have left with a deal, as Mr. Johnson is so proud to say, it's only the outlines of a deal, really, and there will be very intense negotiations, particularly on an area like financial services, which covers about 80% of the British economy and has still not been settled at all. For the last 40 years or so, British citizens have been able to travel, work, study, and live in other European Union member states without any extra visas or paperwork to do, whereas now we've lost that. All our freedom of movement is gone. All we can do is visit as tourists for a limited period of time, up to 90 days in any 180-day period.
Demonstrators have marched through the streets of the U.S. city of Chicago in memory of the victims of gun violence. Protesters were angry at rising cases of gun violence in Chicago, the third largest city in the U.S. They held portraits of their loved ones who had been shot. Demonstrators said their march was aimed at raising awareness about the high level of gun violence in their city.
Well, from my nephew. On June 20th, he was killed due to gun violence. His name was Brandon McGee, and he died at 23. People live in a bubble, and they ignore the fact that this exists. And people need to open their eyes and realize that the gun violence is just as important as COVID.
The protesters urged action to stop what they called easy access to guns in America. The FBI said homicides increased by nearly 21% across the UK, US, I should say, in the first 9 months of 2020. In Chicago alone, homicides increased 55% compared to 2019. That's according to police there. They said shootings also rose 53%. The governor of the U.S. state of California says the first case of the mutated strain of coronavirus has been found in his region.
Some news out of this state. Just an hour or so ago, we were informed that this new variant, this new strain that we've identified, obviously, from the United Kingdom, some other parts of the globe, identified in Colorado yesterday, has been identified here in the state of California.
Newsom made the remarks in a video conference with U.S. disease expert Anthony Fauci. California is one of the hardest hit American states by the pandemic. Total COVID deaths in the western state now top 25,000. Authorities say hospitals are swamped. Nurses and doctors are being pushed to the breaking point. The U.S. itself is the worst affected nation in the world. No need to say the country has so far registered over 345,000 deaths out of nearly 20 million cases. And the year 2020 was filled with exceptionally significant incidents, from massive protests to war and destruction. Many people believe the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic could put a stop to these events, but it didn't. Let's take a look at some of the most noticeable incidents of the past 12 months.
Australia witnessed one of its most destructive and devastating bushfires in the country's history. During the time known as Black Summer, 33 people died and many more were injured. 24 million hectares of land was burnt, 3,000 homes were destroyed, and 3 billion animals killed or displaced. More than 60,000 koalas were among the animals badly affected by the inferno. Indians started the year 2020 protesting a new citizenship law introduced by the government. The law, which is called Citizenship Amendment Act, gives Indian citizenship to illegal migrants who entered India before 2014 following religious persecutions. The law mentions every religion except Islam. The first wave of protests was held in December 2019 when the bill was passed, but protests continued for the next 4 months. Thousands were arrested and dozens killed, including minors. The rallies stopped due to the nationwide lockdowns the government enforced to curb the spread of COVID-19. A new wave of clashes, the worst in decades, broke out between Azeri troops and Armenian-backed forces in the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh. While neighbors and the international community called for de-escalation of tensions, Armenia and Azerbaijan kept attacking and accusing each other of provocation. The contested region, home to ethnic Armenian people, is internationally recognized as Azerbaijani territory, but had been under the control of Armenian-backed separatists since the early 1990s, after they seized it by military force. After weeks of deadly conflict, the two sides signed a peace deal in November. After a four-year inquiry, a report on Australian army war crimes in Afghanistan was released to the public. The report, which is widely known as Brereton War Crimes Report, found out that a group of soldiers within the Australian Defence Force's elite Special Air Services and Commandos Regiment had brutally killed at least 39 Afghan civilians, including children. The report stated that 25 Australian military personnel were involved in the killings. The ongoing protests in Hong Kong started in 2019 over a now-shelved extradition law. The rallies that usually turned ugly resulted in millions of dollars of property damage, as well as mass arrests. However, since the government imposed a ban on public meetings to curb the coronavirus outbreak, Hong Kong has been relatively calm. But every now and then, a demonstration erupts. The anti-government protesters now demand complete separation from mainland China. The Chinese government says the United States and Britain fanned the flames of the unrest in Hong Kong by supporting the rioters.
That's it for me for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And trying to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
Allah. این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
كتاب الله.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 21 of Surah Jathiyah.
أَمْ حَسِبَ الَّذِينَ اجْتَرَحُوا السَّيِّئَاتِ أَن نَجْعَلَهُمْ كَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ سَوَاءً مَحْيَاهُمْ وَمَمَاتُهُمْ سَاءَ مَا يَحْكُمُونَ.
Do those who have perpetrated misdeeds suppose that we shall treat them as those who have faith and do righteous deeds, their life and death being equal? Evil is the judgment they make. Remember, in our last episode of this series, a fortnight ago, while explaining the previous ayahs of this surah, we said Islam, which is culmination of the messages preached by the prophets of the past, reached perfection through the universal mission revealed to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We also said faith is based on insight and awareness in order to guide others with certitude, while piety makes a person deserving of divine protection, since one of the characteristics of the pious is their abstaining from the meaningless goals and desires of the ignorant and deviated elements. The Noble Quran is the source of insight and knowledge in all ideological, ethical, social, political, and family matters, which means that those who adhere to the letter and spirit of its teachings are believers, while those who do not believe in it are disbelievers. Thus, the ayah that we recited to you now draws a comparison between a believer and a disbeliever, saying the two cannot be equal in the sight of God, the just and the all-merciful, who has given ample time and opportunities for the sinners and the faithless to repent and reform themselves. In other words, those who continue in the state of disbelief and misdeeds are neither equal to the believers and the virtuous while alive nor after death. Indeed, evil and unjustified are the expectations of the disbelievers, and the judgment they make by thinking they are equal with those who are patient and resigned to the will of God, irrespective of being healthy or sick, poor or rich, and experiencing the ups or downs of life. On the contrary, disbelievers are always in distress and anxiety, even if they enjoy all bounties and live in luxury and wealth. At the time of death, these two groups will have quite different fates. The believers will be given tidings of paradise, and the disbelievers the news of the fires of hell awaiting them. From this ayah, we learn, number one, God is just and the all-merciful, and certainly, the believers and disbelievers are not equal in his sight. Number two, the criterion for reward or punishment is our own deeds rather than undue wishes. And number three, those who are undeserving because of their misdeeds, and moreover are not inclined to repent, reform, and rectify their faults, should not further deceive themselves through wise expectations or make irrational judgments. Now we listen to ayah 22 of the same surah.
وَخَلَقَ اللَّهُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ بِالْحَقِّ وَلِتُجْزَى كُلُّ نَفْسٍ بِمَا كَسَبَتْ وَهُمْ لَا يُظْلَمُونَ.
Allah created the heavens and the earth with reason, so that every soul may be requited for what it has earned, and they will not be wronged. This ayah substantiates the preceding one that dismissed the notion of disbelievers and believers being equal to each other as nothing but wishful thinking. Here, the Almighty Creator means to say that He, the All-Wise, has created the heavens and the earth with reason and with a purpose to make truth prevail over falsehood. It refers to the fact that the All-Merciful God, who has created the universe in perfect order for the benefit of mankind, the best of creation, will not wrong anyone, the least, which means those who believe and lead a virtuous life will indeed reap the rewards, while those persisted in disbelief, sins, and misdeeds, despite the long respite given to them to correct their behavior, has wronged themselves and hence suffer the consequences of their own evil ways. From this ayah we learn, number one, the entire creation is based on justice and with a purpose behind, which means every person will be judged in a fair and merciful manner on the basis of the deeds he or she did while alive. Number two, the day of judgment will see the final triumph of truth and justice over falsehood and oppression. And number three, the all-loving Creator never wrongs anyone, and it is only we who wrong ourselves by refusing to believe in truth and righteousness while persisting in disobedience of God and indulgence in sins and oppression of others. Thank you. Now we listen to Ayah 23 of Surah Jathiyah.
أفرأيت من اتخذ إلهه هواه وأضله الله على علم وختم على سمعه وقلبه وجعل على بصره غشاوة فمن يهديه من بعد الله أفلا تذكرون.
Have you seen him who has taken his desire to be his God and whom Allah has left astray knowingly and set a seal upon his hearing and his heart and put a blindfold on his sight? So who will guide him after Allah? Will you not then take admonition? When those who follow vain desires and regard pursuit of carnal pleasures as their goals in life or objects of worship, these sins will block their capability to the hearing of good, harden and darken their hearts toward perception of facts, and blur their vision to the aesthetic beauty of the world of creation. As a result, the words of truth may not affect them to the extent that the all-merciful God, who had provided them ample opportunities to discern between good and evil, leaves them astray to their own fate, since they have spurned all means of guidance. In other words, God has made available to mankind the means of deliverance from error. But when a person persists in disbelief, unbridled misdeeds, unabated sins, and habitual oppression of others, such persons deprive themselves of divine guidance. In other words, it is not divine will to leave such persons astray, but it is their own drifting away from guidance and immersion in sins and wanton pleasures that make them deserving of divine wrath. In this way, the Lord Most High exhorts us to take admonition. From this ayah, we learn the following points. Number one, deities have differed in form throughout history, ranging from the worship of wooden or stone objects by the deviated ones to prostrations to the sun and the moon, as well as blind pursuit of carnal desires to the extent of adorning them. Number two, indulgence in evil ways and immersion in sins deprive persons of seeing or hearing facts and realities, with the mind losing its power of rationality and the heart becoming devoid of faith, compassion and humanitarian values. Let us now listen to ayahs 24 and 25 of the same surah.
وقالوا ما هي إلا حياتنا الدنيا نموت ونحيا وما يهلكنا إلا الدهر وما لهم بذلك من علم إن هم إلا يظنون وإذا تتلى عليهم آياتنا بينات ما كان حجتهم إلا أن قالوا ائتوا بآبائنا إن كنتم صادقين.
They say, there is nothing but the life of this world. We live and we die, and nothing but time destroys us. But they do not have any knowledge of that, and they only make conjectures. And when our manifest signs are recited to them, their only argument is to say, bring our fathers back to life, should you be truthful. The Arabic word dahr in ayah 24 denotes the passage of time. Materialists devoid of faith in God and belief in the day of resurrection and divine judgment claim that the passage of life, time leads to human perdition. Since They follow vain desires and are oblivious of spiritual values. Their minds fail to understand the signs around them of the majesty of God, and their hearts lose perception of realities, thereby making them deny resurrection and judgment. As a result, they regard existence restricted to life and death, with nothing afterwards. They thus follow the dictum, make most of life without regard for good or evil, wrong or right, virtue or vice, and that everything is destroyed by the passage of time. It is obvious their words are not substantiated by proper knowledge, since their intellect has lost the power to discern certitude from conjecture. As the next ayah means to say, when the ayahs of the Noble Quran are recited as manifest signs of God Almighty, instead of pondering upon facts, the disbelievers retort that if the prophets are truthful, then raise our forefathers back to life so that we ask them what had transpired after death. In other words, they fail to grasp the finer points of divine wisdom in providing plenty of signs in the world of nature and in the human being itself of the long respite given to understand the eventuality of resurrection. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, blind pursuit of materialistic life with immersion in sins deprives a person of faith in God and thereby denial of the hereafter. Number two, there is no logical argument for the disbeliever's denial of resurrection. And number three, it is the height of absurdity to demand that their dead are immediately brought back to life.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. An affront to justice. That's how the UN has described President Trump's recent pardons for Blackwater mercenaries. Rights experts complain that a pardon for the four security contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians in 2007 undermines humanitarian law. UN experts have reminded the fact that based on the Geneva Convention, war criminals must be held accountable for their crimes even when acting as private security contractors. That's the topic of our debate show tonight. Stay with us for that. Now let's go to Washington, D.C. to our own correspondent, Dr. Colin Campbell. Colin, last week we were discussing the same issue from a different angle, and there was media blackout. The majority of mainstream U.S. media didn't mention this. So now the UN has taken it to a different level. It's now some kind of legal challenge. What about now?
That's right, and it looks like the media has picked up on it a little bit, really expressing outrage from some of the commentators that have remarked about the pardons that the president made for these contractors from Blackwater. As we understand, this was an egregious crime that was committed with the slaughter of innocent Iraqi civilians that were later the perpetrators of this crime now can walk free. So you have some media outlets, if they aren't just saying and stating what happened as a declarative, they're expressing outrage, anger, and just disbelief that these would be the people that the president has pardoned. Now, what is being looked at also is just the whole pardoning process. I think that the president has put a test on the whole system of who is pardoned and why. Usually it is for people who were not afforded equity in under the eyes of the law. Maybe there was a law that was misapplied, or maybe something that was done unjudiciously, or something that was done a little bit too exacting or too draconian in method. Well, this time it seems that this was the president's privilege that he took to pardon people that he felt should be pardoned, or people who were giving deference to the president. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why there are many people who are now questioning just the whole system of who is pardoned. Again, this is not the main story that is coming from U.S. media, but it is something that is being discussed, especially amongst those who are at liberty to discuss the topics of the day with a little bit more freedom in their rhetoric rather than just mm-hmm. stating the news of the day as a flat declarative.
Okay, thank you, Doc. Our own Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. Now, joining me to discuss this a little bit and look at it from different angles, first will be former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaires, out of Geneva. Good to have you with us, Alfred. Welcome to the show. And, these security contractors took the lives of Iraqi civilians back in 2007. On what ground has President Trump pardoned them?
Well, we have a culture of impunity in the United States, and this is only one of many cases. Constitutionally, the president does have the authority to pardon criminals, except that in this case, basically, he's giving his blessing on murder, his blessing on a massive war crime. But it's not just the practice of granting pardons. It's also the consistent pattern of impunity for American soldiers to commit crimes and for private security companies whose members, and we had nearly 100,000 private security officials in Iraq at the time, and there were many other major crimes committed. It's not just this one in Nusra Square in 2007. I remember the crimes committed at the time of the rape of Fallujah, and we know the crimes committed in Guantanamo. It's a daily torture situation that has been repeatedly condemned by United Nations rapporteurs. And all of these persons involved in these crimes have enjoyed and continue enjoying impunity. As an American, I can say not in my name. I mean, I find it egregious, I find it outrageous. But as Campbell just said, the mainstream media doesn't like to carry these stories. Mm-hmm. I recall when I was a young student at Harvard, that was during the Vietnam War, and there were all of these war crimes committed by American soldiers against the Vietnamese people, civilians, women, children. Very little made it to the press, and it was us, the activists, the students, who were protesting because we had heard about these things and we wanted to see accountability on the part of American soldiers. Who was tried? This insignificant Lieutenant William Calley, instead of trying General Maxwell Taylor, instead of holding the hires up accountable for the systematic crimes being committed in Vietnam. And for decades now, since the beginning of the so-called war on terror, we've had a problem of so-called secret prisons, the problem of extraordinary renditions Mm-hmm. And my colleague and rapporteur on human rights while combating terrorism, Ben Emerson, did a study on extraordinary renditions. And it turned out that 54 countries in the world participated in the extraordinary renditions. And countries like Poland, Romania, Egypt, etc., all participated in this completely illegal program of kidnapping and sending people to be tortured. I mean, we had special agreement with Egypt, and we sent people specifically to be tortured in Egypt. Wow. And of course, we continued the torture in Guantanamo, and as I said, in total impunity, because no one has ever been held accountable.
Okay. Now let me also invite Sina Ellis with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams out of New York. Good to have you with us, sir. Ian, rights groups argue that allowing private security firms like Blackwater to operate with impunity in armed conflicts will embolden the states to circumvent their obligations under humanitarian law. Is that true?
Yes, quite clearly. I was present at the first, the negotiations that led to the signing of the UN, of the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to a lot of the State Department and U.S. military analysts and lawyers who were involved. And their sincere thesis was that because the law only allowed for prosecution if the state concerned had failed, then it was okay. Americans were protected because they said, we have the best military justice system in the world. I had memories of Milei, like our other interlocutor there, where you might remember it took something like 30 years for the pilot of the helicopter that stopped the massacre to be recognized by Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton was the president at the time and was at least paying lip service when the treaty was signed. We know that the U.S. couldn't ratify it because of Republican opposition, and it's on the basic same principle. The U.S. can never do any wrong. I mean, it's American exceptionalism to the max. That first of all, the U.S. can do no wrong, and secondly, that anyone wearing a uniform must be supported, which we're seeing with police impunity, with military impunity. Now, he shot somebody in full daylight who was unarmed, but he's a policeman doing his duty, so we must support him. It's that attitude that pervades the whole system, and it really has come out here because these people were, that they were paid security guards, that they were like the doorman in a nightclub. I mean, it's like giving the bouncer in a nightclub the option to kill people at will. And internationally, that's how it will be seen. This was a clear massacre. Not the only one, by the way. They haven't even tried to investigate the massacre in the square that WikiLeaks revealed, where a helicopter up in the air gunned down a Reuters camera crew and then gunned down the people who went to rescue them and give them medical aid. That hasn't even been investigated yet, let alone prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a whole level of impunity which needs examination. Of course, we know, in fact, that the people who leaked that, they are being persecuted by the government, but not the people who kept it secret, who did it, who ordered it, who provided the circumstances, empowered those people to go in and kill civilians. And it's bad for the U.S. in every way, not just morally, but if you're going to be cynical, it means that their word is worth nothing when it comes to looking for war criminals abroad. Who would hand over somebody to the United States as a suspected war criminal, knowing the United States' partial record, where they protect the guilty when it's theirs and persecute the innocent when they're foreigners?
Okay. Now back to Geneva. Alfred, UN rights experts are also warning that pardons and amnesties, I'm quoting them, open doors for future abuses when states use the service of private military and security companies for inherent state functions. Do you share the same opinion?
Well, I've written that in some of my own reports to the Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly. Indeed, in the ontology of the state is to keep an army and to keep discipline in that army. The main problem with private security companies is that it's an attempt to outsource this ontological responsibility of the state. And there the so-called status of forces abroad agreements that essentially grant them total immunity in the countries where they're operating, in this case Iraq, on the assumption that if they commit a crime, that they will be under in personam jurisdiction of United States courts, and that the military will actually investigate those allegations of war crimes, and that those responsible will be brought to justice. Well, here we have four individuals from Blackwater who were in fact brought to court and convicted back in 2014 for murder. It is a disgrace for a country under the rule of law that it would be tolerated that a crime as egregious as this one would be subject to pardoning. But as Mr. Trump said, these were people who had a long history of service to our nation, and therefore they deserve being pardoned. Now, this is like a mafia boss saying, well, they're my boys. You know, my boys are good boys. And that, when I was a young student in high school in Chicago, I mean, I remember the kind of daily indoctrination, if you want. You know, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. One nation under God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What does that mean? Is that we are indoctrinated in believing that we, Americans, are, by definition, the good guys. We're always the good guys. Our soldiers do not commit war crimes. Our private military security officers do not commit war crimes. Only the other side commits war crimes. And that's what we need is universal jurisdiction,
right,
so that countries other than the United States, when an American official goes to, say, Switzerland, that if he is, say, the Minister of Defense, and he comes to Switzerland, well, he has responsibility for all the war crimes that have been committed under his jurisdiction,
right,
if he has not ensured accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So universal jurisdiction is a concept that has to be played in.
Right. Now, Ian, in a statement announcing this controversial pardons just a few days ago, the White House said that the move was broadly supported by the public and also backed by a number of Republican lawmakers. Is that really the case?
Well, I'm fairly sure it was backed by a large number of Republican lawmakers, because they're looking over their shoulders at the the Trump supporters who will or won't vote for them. I mean, you know, if Adolf Hitler had the good sense to wear a GI's uniform, these people would all be supporting him, no problem. But on the other side, they if they were putting when we're talking about the public. Is the public aware of it? That's the real problem. And I think my colleague here was making the point, the public is not aware of most of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask them about Milei, it's not on their list of battles. If you ask them about Abu Ghraib, if you ask them about Guantanamo, this is not big on the mental horizon. It's an issue that's buried very thoroughly. If it's brought up at all by the media, it's very likely, because the media has exactly the same prejudices. Our guys are right, the other side are wrong. If our guys are wrong now and again, then we should cut them some slack, because they're doing this for us after all. I mean, there is a cult of the uniform and the veteran here in the United States, which pervades everything. A veteran, I mean, you know, a veteran can do no wrong. In fact, lots of veterans do wrong. And, you know, the whole point of people in uniform is you're training them to go abroad and kill people. Mm-hmm. And they often do it, you know, excessively, with too much zeal. And so people do feel sympathy for them. You know, I've spoken, everyone calls the Second World War the finest war. I've spoken to many veterans who tell horrifying stories about what happened to prisoners who fell into their hands if they were inconvenient. And, but they're just ignored. People know about them, but the reality is obscured to preserve this overall vision that the United States is a city on the hill. It's not just the United States, of course. Lots of other countries. The British have never held responsible those who committed atrocities in Kenya or in South Yemen or in India, come to think of it. The other places where they're involved. The French have never come to terms with Algeria. So, you know, it's not a uniquely American problem.
Right.
But it is because America is, the United States is the sort of founding partner of the United Nations, keeps upholding, keeps saying it's taking action to uphold international law. Its actions against Iran are wreathed in the obligations to under international law and order. And yet it completely flouts it whenever it suits them. And in this particular case, there were options. I mean, Donald Trump could have said, oh, well, look, these guys, they were young, they're in a terrible situation, so I'll exercise clemency. We'll commute their sentences. But he didn't. He said a pardon. And the pardon implies this is all right, that they are, in effect, judicially speaking, innocent.
Yeah, but I wonder if Trump knows the difference between pardon and clemency. Now,
It's a tough call, I agree.
All right. Alfred, you both talked about, Ian talked about global jurisdiction. The ICC, ICJ, I mean, the U.S. does not recognize, you know, these international tribunals. So we have had a long record of the U.S. doing things, similar things since the Korea War, the things that the U.S. did in Afghanistan, you know, the UN probe about it and all that. So is there a remedy to this exceptionalism, U.S. forces always being good guys, infallible, great, you know, guys who never do anything wrong?
Well, it's up to us Americans to make sure that our fellow Americans, shall we say, grow up and realize that exceptionalism is not the way forward. But we still live in this bubble, and we still believe that we are the good guys. And it took me decades, actually, to separate myself from that, to say, jump over my own shadow, to think outside the box. Not everybody does that. Here you are in your comfort zone. But while we're talking about universal jurisdiction, I mean, this can be done, and actually it has occurred. Back years ago, 2007 or 2008, when Donald Rumsfeld went to a right-wing group to speak in Paris, he had to escape because there was a warrant for his arrest. And he left Paris and he went into Germany and was flown back to the United States with a military plane. So you see that there is a possibility under international law to prosecute for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and under the Convention Against Torture, which the United States has ratified.
Right.
Under the Convention Against Torture, there is an obligation of the territorial state to arrest and try whatever person is within its jurisdiction, in its territory, like Donald Rumsfeld at that moment,
right,
who is accused of having committed torture. That is, not he personally, but he as the responsible minister whose soldiers committed torture in Guantanamo and elsewhere. Let me just say one point.
Okay, we have only a few seconds left.
Assange and Snowden, we demand absolutely, and we must demand as Americans, that the president grant pardon both to Julian Assange and to Edward Snowden, both of whom are human rights defenders.
Okay.
And they have done more for the world than many others, and I think that